So, thank you for the invitation. And okay, recording in progress. Very good. So, let me just be sure the slide's changing. This is the first slide. Oops, let me click on this. Second slide, did that switch all right?
Yes, sir. No.
Okay, perfect. So, we're going to be talking about receiver performance, transceiver performance. So, that includes transmitters. But also, I want to say the most important thing that you can improve, if you can, is your put your effort on your antenna first. So if you are in an HOA, maybe your options are limited, but that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. So the receivers today are amazing compared to 20 and 30 years ago, but we want to optimize how we use it, whatever you've got. So that's going to be the goal today, to optimize your rig, and that's partially comes down to net receiver gain, and I'll explain that and why that's important. So that basically means, when do you use a preamp and when do you not? Or when do you use an attenuator and when would you not? And this is particularly important with some of the latest rigs, which would be the new Elecraft, the 7610 from ICOM, and the Flex 6600 or the 6400. So we'll go into detail on that. Sometimes I'll get phone calls or emails and say, I want to work more DX, so what's the most sensitive receiver on the market? And that's kind of a silly question, because sensitivity or noise floor is not an issue, hasn't been for a long time. For instance, here's a data going back to 1954 with an R390A, clear up through a Drake receiver, which I did mods for like 45 years, and then the K3S, which was into production up to about 3 years ago. So look, sensitivity the same, noise floor within 1 dB over that 60-year period. So this is not something we have to worry about. So what is noise floor and sensitivity? So noise floor was defined in 1975 so that there was a 3 dB signal plus noise ratio in a CW bandwidth. Well, what does that mean? If you have a signal generator and you fed in a signal and you adjusted it so that when you tune the signal out of the passband and looked at the audio coming out your speaker with a meter with a dB scale, and then you put the signal back in the passband, it would go up 3 dB. And that means that the signal is the same level as the noise. So you're measuring the actual noise floor of the receiver. Sensitivity that, from a sideband standpoint, probably goes back to the 50s and certainly the 60s. And so in that case, we're measuring in a wider bandwidth, a sideband bandwidth, and we do the same type of test, except the meter goes up not 3 dB, but it goes up 10 dB. But actually, to your ear, they sound about the same, because the 10 dB is in a wider bandwidth with more noise, the 3 dB is in a narrower bandwidth, so that the acoustic difference isn't all that great. And this noise floor can also be called MDS, minimum discernible signal, even though you can actually hear below that, but that's the definition. So I'm going to talk about those three radios that are really very different than what we've probably had if we go back several years to back 10, 20, 30 years. You see in the right-hand column, the dynamic range are identical. Every radio has a variation in sample to sample and measurement error of a dB or something. So just consider these three popular radios, 100 dB radios, which is something we dreamed of 20 or 30 years ago. But look at the noise floor, or in other words, the sensitivity, if you're talking sideband, is very different with the preamp off. So if we look at the Flex, and this would apply to the 6400 also, the noise floor is such with no preamp that you might want to run a preamp on 20 meters in a quiet location, which is somewhat atypical. Now, if you look at the ICOM, well, that noise floor is quite low with no preamps. So in that case, you're more likely to want to run attenuation on the low bands. And there's the K4, kind of right in the middle. And so I doubt you'd want to run a preamp on 20 meters, but on 10 meters, you probably would, if you're in a quiet location. So what I'm saying is, none of these designs are wrong. They're just different. So if you own one of these radios, you just need to know, okay, my radio is, maybe it's like the Flex, or maybe it's like the ICOM. So you have to operate the radio differently just because they've designed it differently. But all of them have preamps and to some extent attenuation. So this is out of the ALLL handbook. This is what noise is like versus frequency at either residential, rural, or quiet rural. Now the rural and quiet rural is what I see out at my QTH where I am right now. And the rural number actually is pretty much towards the Caribbean for me. That's sort of my noisiest direction. But I do see quiet rural, the dotted line at the bottom, towards like Japan. But unfortunately, their residential graph, that solid graph, solid line, that's probably should be 10 dB higher today. See, this number was, data was taken quite a while ago. And as you probably know, urban noise is just going up and up with all these electronic things. So here's some tabular data taken off that graph. And you can see that around 160 at night, band noise is about minus 87 dBm. But then on 10 meters in the daytime, it's 30 dB quieter or more on 10 meters versus noisier on 160. And of course, they're in the middle. So we really need to take into account what band are we on and what's our gain structure and what should we be doing to optimize the transceiver on receive so it either doesn't overload or we can hear the weak signals depending on the band. So there's my dream station out here about 40 miles east of WWV. And you can see that I kind of went crazy, but it's really been fun to build this up over the last 15 years. So here's data that I took back in 2013 around the compass 360 degrees to look at my band noise on 20, 15, and 10. And you can see, of course, it varies. As I said, it's much quieter towards JA or VK than it is towards the Caribbean. So the numbers on each column that are in red are the highest noise level. And you can see it's pretty much towards the southeast. And then you compare that measured number with my beams to that number off the chart from the ALLL and the ITU within a dB or two of each other. So you can see that that dashed line that was rural noise is a very valid number. So here's going to be my assumption is what mistake could a ham typically make? And it's not all that intuitive. You say, well, if in doubt, turn the preamp on. Well, only when you need to. I'll explain how to decide that. And it's pretty easy. You can do it by ear. You don't have to have a meter. And when do you turn the attenuator on? My guess is most of us don't turn the attenuator on when it's appropriate. So we really need to know when do we push those buttons to turn the preamp on or the attenuator? The thing that we also want to do is adjust our AGC threshold so that band noise isn't running the AGC all the time because that's tiring. And I'll explain that. And what we're really wanting to know is if we switch between a dummy load and the antenna, how much louder is the band noise coming in versus our receiver noise? And to have the receiver noise to be insignificant compared to band noise, you would want the band noise to be about 10 dB louder than the receiver noise, and then the receiver noise isn't much of an issue. So it just happened to be 2 days ago when I got up here, I was making some measurements and playing with diversity with the 7610. And this was on 15 meters. And I had my antenna pointed to the southeast, which is my noisiest direction. And my antenna noise gain actually was more than I'd needed. And so turning a preamp on that day, pointed towards the Caribbean, would be pointless. But if I was trying to work a JA and there was this contest this weekend, this digital contest for FT8 and FT4, well, if I was pointing to Japan, that'd be a different story. So let's look at some measured numbers on 15, 10, and 6 meters. Now, I measured this with a meter hooked up to my speaker. It has a dB scale. I happen to use the true RMS meter, but you don't need to do that. If you've got any type of a meter that has a dB scale, you can make the measurement. It's going to be close enough. So these were all 5-element Yagis up in the air between 50 and 70 feet. Well, if you let's look at 10 meters, because that's a key amount of information here. So I would switch to my termination or my dummy load. Now, if let's say your receiver has an RX port that you don't use, well, you could put a little 2-watt termination on it, and that could be your dummy load. It's only on receive, you're making this measurement. But if you, hopefully we all have a dummy load, because if something kind of goes wrong, it's nice to be able to switch to a dummy load and see, okay, the transmitter's putting out 100 watts, so that's not the problem. So we would then switch to your dummy load or termination, adjust the volume on your receiver so that it was reading on this meter some reference point, and then we'd switch to the antenna. No signal tuned in, of course. And in this case, on 10 meters, it only went up 3 dB with no preamp. Well, that's significant because that means the receiver is contributing half the noise and the band noise is the other half. Well, you don't want your receiver to be limiting weak signal reception to that extent. So there's the time that say, well, let's try the preamp. So in this case, it happened to be a Pro 3 that has two preamps. And so when I switch preamp one on and switch between the dummy load and the band noise, it went up 9.5 dB. Perfect. We don't need to go above that. But then on 6 meters, I've never used a 6-meter rig, a rig that covers six, and everybody's rig today, if it's new, is carrot cover 6 meters, that you didn't need a preamp on six in a quiet location. So let's look at the measurement I made then. No preamp, switch between the dummy load and the antenna. It barely moved the meter, went up 1 dB, and you can just barely hear 1 dB. Well, that's not enough. So it switched on preamp one. Well, it only went up 4.5 dB. So that'd mean the receiver is probably contributing a little less than half the noise, but still a problem. But then the radio happened to have a second preamp, and voila, switch to between the dummy load and the antenna, 9.5 dB. Perfect. So in that case, we need the 6 meters quiet direction. And in my case, that's like to Cheyenne, Wyoming, but I've got a noise source to the east and it's not there to the west. So you just have to see which way you're pointing if you do have a Yagi or some type of a directional antenna. So here's a typical transceiver. This happened to be a TS-990. And the noise floor, this measurement, that 3 dB measurement, with the preamp off is about minus 127, which would be adequate on the, certainly on many bands, but probably not on 10. So on 10 meters with the preamp on, minus 138. That's a very common number for most of the transceivers with the preamp. But remember, the noise on 40 meters at night, in that tabular chart, if you happen to look at the 40 meter number, it's about minus 100. Well, if the preamp is off on this transceiver, or virtually any transceiver, the noise floor of the receiver is way lower than band noise on 40 meters at night. So in this case, I typically would run 12 dB attenuation at night on 40 meters. If the S meter is reading upscale on band noise, then there's no point in that. So then in this case, let's say you punch in your 6 dB attenuator and probably nothing happens as far as the noise coming out at your speaker or your headphones. And maybe you switch to your 12 dB attenuator and then suddenly you notice, oh, the noise went down a little bit. So this is what we want to keep track of. So on 160, I might run 18 dB and on 80 meters, probably 12, and some of the newest rigs, the 7610 and the K4, you can adjust that attenuator in 3 dB steps, not 6, so that's kind of convenient. So how do you optimize the threshold? Well, I would say I recommend that as you go back and forth between your attenuator settings, you'd like the noise coming out your speaker or your headphones to go down about 6 dB. And that, depending on your radio, you can use your attenuator, your RF gain, or some of the radios have an AGC threshold adjustment that's totally separate. That would be the Flex, which has something called AGC-T, so AGC threshold. And I would say somewhere between 50 and 60 is a starting point. And the Apache has a horizontal line that's on the Windows display, and you move that up or down, and it adjusts your AGC threshold. So what I'll find in working a contest, maybe if you're just rag-chewing and everybody's 20 over 9, so what? But you're on the air for, who knows, in a contest, 10 hours, 20 hours, or people who have more stamina than I, more than that. It's really tiring if you're tuning between signals, or even if you're running and you're waiting for the next guy to call you. If band noise is as loud as every signal you're working, that really makes you tired. So if you've adjusted your threshold so that band noise is reduced, at least 60 dB, maybe a little more, is that a trade-off? Of course, everything in life has a trade-off. So occasionally, I have to turn up the volume control to work this guy that's really weak. Most stations in a contest are not that weak. So I would say a few percent of the time would I have to turn the volume up, as the trade-off, though, is, oh, I'm less tired after all those hours of operation. So dynamic range, well, this is sort of what I'm known for on my website. It has those 150 transceivers and receivers that are sorted by close-in dynamic range. As I said earlier, sensitivity isn't an issue, but we need the sensitivity measurement, or that noise floor measurement, to calculate dynamic range as we measure it in the lab. But today, we're so lucky that it doesn't matter which brand you've got. You know, the top six brands, let's say, you can get a 95 dB radio from about anybody at that close-in number, which is particularly important for CW and RDI contests, less so for sideband. So what does dynamic range really mean? And again, besides noise floor being defined in 1975 in QST and Ham Radio Magazine, they define dynamic range as, in effect, when the receiver starts generating distortion products, or in other words, interference on its own, that, so we're going to define that as the dynamic range between the noise floor and the point the receiver just begins to overload. It can also be called spurious free dynamic range. But for a long time, when synthesizers came along, we got general coverage receivers, we got digital readout, we didn't have drift anymore. But the synthesizers, for like 25 years ago, they were really pretty terrible. So most of the time, when I was measuring performance of a transceiver, the phase noise was the limit. And this wasn't defined until 2012 by the ARRL, and then it kind of dropped the ball for a little while. But by 2013 or 2014, you would see the reciprocal mixing dynamic range number published in addition to the dynamic range number, which was typically done at 20 kilohertz, and now finally 2 kilohertz, like I started doing in 1977. So I'm going to give you an example of how you really need to look at the reviews carefully to see what is really happening. So before this reciprocal mixing dynamic range metric was defined in 2012, the ARRL tested the FTDX3000 from Yaesu. Now, the advertisements in the magazine said the dynamic range was 106 dB. I don't know where that came from. I never saw anything like that. But the leak measured it as 100, which sounds like, wow, that's great, certainly that long ago. But when I published my data on my website for the FTDX3000, I happened to do that before the QST review. And in my case, I always list the worst number. If the dynamic range, third order dynamic range, was, let's just say, 80, and the reciprocal mixing dynamic range was 70, well, I listed the lower number because that's what we have to deal with on the air. If the receiver is the limit, and most of the time it's not, thank goodness, but if it is the limit, we want to know the worst case scenario. So the leak, by measuring the dynamic range in a strange way with a 1 hertz filter, and I've asked many times out, how many people in the audience use a 1 hertz filter on CW? So far, nobody's raised their hand. But they were doing that measurement so that the phase noise would be eliminated So they could really measure the third order product, but in this case, it was buried in 18 dB of phase noise. So it really was meaningless. But then if you actually looked at the less obvious data that was in the QST review, and it was really just one line of text, they said the reciprocal mixing dynamic range, which they didn't use that term, was 82 dB, which was the same thing that's on my website. So in that case, 82 dB is what you want to look at. So if there's two numbers in a review, third order number, and then any kind of reciprocal mixing number, whichever number is lower, take that to the bank. Now, I was mentioning that the testing originally, back in the 70s and 80s, was just done with two signals 20 kilohertz apart. And that was okay for testing a radio design in the 50s and the 60s. But once we started getting radios with crystal roofing filters, didn't matter what frequency the roofing filter was, well, then everything changed because there was a lot more gain before we got to the final selectivity. So the 20 kilohertz numbers usually looked really good, maybe in the 90s or even a radio that was not performing that well in a CW pileup. So when I was using my Drake and using it in a contest, and my friend KRRH in Cincinnati was doing the same thing, we found that the radio would overload. Well, if the radio is overloading, but the published data says it's like a 90 dB radio, well, something's wrong because the radio is what it is. The number says it's good, and the contest says it's falling apart in a big pileup. Well, then the test is not right. So that's what I did way back there in the late 70s, was move my two test signals to 2 kilohertz instead of 20 in addition. So I did both. So anything with a really wide roofing filter that had the test signals inside the roofing filter, the dynamic range was pretty much 70 dB. That's not adequate for CW or RTTY, but for sideband, it kind of is, because in sideband, unfortunately, the splatter is kind of dominates if a guy's up the band 3, 4, 5 kilohertz. So we lived with that for about 20, 25 years, because that's all we had with the upconversion radios. And then things changed. The Orion 1 came along and the Orion 2, and then, of course, the K3 came along, and boy, did that change the world. So what they did was go back to having a first IF filter of whichever bandwidth you're using for your mode. If it was sideband, you had a 2.7 or a 2.8. If you're on CW, you had a 400 or a 500 or a 200. So in this case, because the test signals, even at 2 kilohertz, didn't go through the roofing filter, we got some big numbers for a lot of radios. The K3S, the TS890S, the 101D, for instance. Now you say, well, what if we got two signals inside that 400 hertz roofing filter? Well, we would actually be back to that 70 dB, but in that case, key clicks would probably be the limit, probably not the overload of the radio, because I'll show you a slide in a moment about that. So now then along came direct sampling radios, Apache, the K4 now from Elecraft, the Flex ever since they went to the 6000 series, and the ICOM with the 7300, 7610, or the 9700, and now the 705, there is no roofing filters. It, by definition, a direct sampling radio has no filters at all, probably. It's all DSP, it's all digital. So the direct sampling radios are pretty consistent. There is some variation, which I'll explain in a moment, but they're pretty much 100 dB, and like we couldn't buy a 100 dB radio 25 years ago. So we still have a combination now today. We've got standard superhet like a K3 or K3S. We've got the hybrid radios, which are like a TS890S or an FTDX101D or 101MP. And so in some cases, if you've got signals 70 over 9, 80 over 9, 90 over 9, now I've never seen a skip signal that strong, but if you've got field day or a neighbor that's a mile away, let alone 10 blocks away, if you're seeing signals that are, you know, let's just say S9 plus 80 dB, the radio with the roofing filter will have an advantage. Luckily, we don't see that very often. So for instance, if you look at the data on my website on the blocking dynamic range for the K3S, it's really great, 150 dB. But that's measured with a super clean test signal. So on the air in the real world, an interfering transmission, it's not going to be as clean as this test signal, but it's still going to be an improvement. So let's say even though we can't really get this blocking number of 150, you know, maybe it's 140, whatever it is, but it's still an advantage if you've got a signal 80 over 9. The direct sampling radio, so this is interesting. It happens to be the range that I'm seeing on my website, if you look there. It happens to be two different flexes go as low as 116 or as high as 130. So let's just say the average is about 125. So here's data off my website. And this is the top 22 individual transceiver models. This is not the top 22, like start and just count down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to 22, because there's duplicates in there. For instance, the K3 came out in 2008, or at least I got to test it in 2008, may have come out in late 2007. And then the K3S came along with the new synthesizer. And then there's second samples in some cases, like the direct sampling radios have more variation from individual radio to individual radio than the superheads. Now, not enormous, but there is some difference. So if you look in there, you'll see like a 6600 with two measurements, and they're not just exactly the same. So this is the top 22. And of these 22 transceivers, I've run contests with 17 of these 22 brands and models. But look right in the middle, 100 dB or 99 dB. This is amazing. And we really don't need that much most of the time. So I would say most people, most of the time, they'd be perfectly happy with this 88 dB for the ICOM 705. What a neat little radio if you're into parks on the air or soda or something like that. N2IC is a big contester. Steve London, he lives in New Mexico now. He used to live in Denver. He has a pair of TS-590Ss. You don't have to spend $5,000 for a radio to have good results in a contest. Of course, he has a good location. He has great antennas. He's a wonderful operator, a lot of operator skill that sort of makes my eyes glaze over. And he's got radios that today, if you bought a pair of 590S, they're about $1,400. So you don't really have to break the bank. And one thing that the ICOM 7300 did, which I consider an unbelievably bargain radio, it crashed the used market. So the range on prices today of new equipment is like $1,000 to more than $12,000. But you can buy like a TS-590S for maybe $700 and something a bit older than that for $500 and go to your flea markets and see what you can buy. So if you're a new ham, I don't think you should go spend a pile of money as your first radio. Get something that's within the budget. Put up the best antenna you can. So, okay, we've got a lot of the OEMs now, original equipment manufacturers, are doing direct sampling. That's a big change. So what are the concerns? Well, field day, it's tough. You've got a diameter circle of 1,000 feet. So your antennas can't be more than 1,000 feet apart. And what if you've got a ham that's a mile away, or I've got friends that literally you could throw a baseball from his house to the next ham. Well, this is going to be difficult. So with, for instance, the ICOM, the 7300 or the 7610, and most of the upconversion radios like a Pro 3 was in the past, or the TR7, which may have been the first one, we have a half octave filter. We don't have a preselector anymore. So you're depending on an LC front end to keep other signals that's way off frequency out of the front end, out of the first active stage, the preamp or the ADC chip. But it's quite wide, particularly as we go up in frequency. So on 20 meters, the front end may be passing 11 megahertz to 15 megahertz, and there are commercial signals in there that may be running a lot more power than we're running. In some cases, like with the 7610, you have a tracking preselector option that you can turn on. it's not real sharp. The FTDX101D and the MP have one that's even sharper. So they'll eliminate signals out of the ham band. I would say if you're running, let's say you're operating CW in a contest on 7.005 megahertz, and you're in Europe, like in Germany, well, there's broadcast stations above 7.2 megahertz that are running a megawatt or more. So in that case, that tracking preselector on the 7610 will knock down a signal on, let's say, 72.5, about 10 dB, and even more so with the Yaesu. So that helps out. But then we've also got attenuation on 40 meters at night, which is going to be a problem. I know K3LR was running a 7610 during WRTC when it was in Germany a few years ago. And at night on 40 meters, he was running 9 dB attenuation. He could have run 12. He could have run 15, most likely. So a comment on limitation on reception may not be your receiver in some cases, and this is something that really needs to be emphasized. Radios today often let you adjust the rise time on CW, and this drastically affects key clicks. And you can inadvertently go into a menu, and maybe the default value is not optimum, or it got changed, and you thought, well, maybe one is better than six, which is backwards. So you really want, if your radio has an adjustable rise time, you should pick somewhere between 6 or 8 milliseconds. The ICOM kind of tops out at 6, the Kenwood at 8, so I'd pick one, or the highest one in this case. Now, in the case of the K3 or the K4, that's hard-coded in. In the case of the Flex, it's hard-coded in, so you can't goof it up, and it's set okay. Bob Allison asked Yaesu, get rid of these options that you shouldn't have. So now, with the more recent updates to your Yaesu, your FTDX101D, the MP, or the FTDX10, you can't pick anything faster than 4. I don't recommend 4, but at least you can't pick something that's silly. So to demonstrate this, this is a spectrum analyzer plot of a TS-890S sending dits at 30 words a minute. Now, actually, the speed has no difference. We could be 30. I measured it with a 101 MP at 30 and 60, and the difference was just insignificant. So here you are. I would hope that you could copy a weak signal 1 kilohertz away from a really strong CW signal. But look at the difference in the key clicks. The top graph is that 1 millisecond choice, which shouldn't even be there. And the one at the bottom is the 6 millisecond choice. And you can see the key click difference is 25 dB. Now, if you just had a rock on the key, your signal would be like 200 hertz wide or something. But you're sending, well, it's a contest, 599, right? Everybody's 599. So if you set it for 1, you're going to be a bad neighbor. And that's something at Contest University before Dayton Hamvention each year really emphasizes, the shared bands. We don't want to splatter. We don't want to have key clicks and things like that. So pick your rise time, if it's adjustable, to be 6 or 8 milliseconds. We look, what is rise time? I've never seen rise time. Well, this is what it looks like. The previous one, that's in the frequency domain. That shows the keying sidebands versus frequency. This is in the time domain. That's with a normal scope. So in this case, this happened to be a 10-tech rig, and its range of adjustment was 3 to 10. Well, look on the left. That rise time is how quickly it goes from zero output, in this case 100 watts. It goes up pretty fast, and that's what's causing the key clicks. But then at 10 milliseconds, well, look, it goes up much slower. Now, I might not pick 10, maybe I'll pick 8. But you can see this is what rise time means, how fast you're going from the key up to the key down. So I don't want to think that, well, we should just pick a radio with one number. Maybe I'm sort of guilty of emphasizing that because my chart on the web is listed, as you saw there, by close-in dynamic range for CW and ready, very important. But you don't buy a sports car that can go 150 miles an hour, but it goes into a ditch when you turn a curve. So look at the big picture. You know, rule out the ones that are just not going to be a reasonable choice. And then we need to worry about what's the operator fatigue like if the receive audio is poor, or the AGC doesn't work right. What if the ergonomics are just confusing, or you make waste time going into a menu to make some adjustment that you would do with a regular basis? Or maybe the speech processor doesn't work very well. You might choose a radio that has the best noise blanking and noise reduction because you're in an urban environment and your noise is like S8. And if you've got a radio that can really knock that down, that might be the best choice. Radios today, they're almost all upgradable as far as the firmware. If we go back to that Pro 3 that I had made those measurements with, that was what you got. It never got better, never got worse. But now we can update them either on the web or with a thumb drive or with an SD card. But we hopefully get updates somewhat regularly, maybe new features, bug fixes. Nobody writes perfect software, so we don't want to get a radio that is updatable and the company just sort of forgets about it. Warranty service. I mean, the components today in our surface mount, they're like the size of a grain of salt. I can't fix that. So we need to have good warranty service. Now, I know that Kenwood for a while had a company in California that was terrible. They fired them. There's a new company in New York. Thank goodness, because we really need the ability to have our OEMs to fix our radio. And can they fix it after it's out of production? Can you still get parts? I mean, if it goes out of production and it's 6 months later, you can't get any parts, that's no good. And at the end of the day, whether you're operating in a rag shoe, a contest, doing FT8, whatever, it should be fun. You should enjoy your radio. I've sold a couple of radios that one case that lasted 30 days, another lasted 5 months, and I got rid of it. This wasn't the radio for me. Someone else may have loved it. I didn't. So enjoy using what you've got. I'll send a PDF of this presentation to your club. You can also send me questions to rob@nczrb.com. And now we're going to switch gears. And if there's any Q&A, questions and answers at this point, we've got a little bit of time for that. And then if there is time afterwards, if there's interest on some contest information and lab information on the K4D, the FTDX10, which is a bargain, $1,400, or the little 705 that's DC to light. So go ahead and shoot any questions if you got any.
Not looking like there's many questions in the room, Rob.
If there is, just repeat the question since they'll be in the back there.
I think he was saying that there aren't any questions.
Okay, all right. Well, then we can look. We've still got a few minutes, so let's look at these rigs real quickly. So I'm doing rig comparisons on the three rigs that shipped in the last year and a half. The K4, it's pretty expensive, it's just under $6,000. The FTDX10, that's pretty much $1,400, which is a bargain. And then that amazing little ICOM radio, this 705, at $1,350. And then as comparison on prices, I've got the other popular rigs. The K4 has really only been shipping for 15 or 16 months. Even though it was announced like 3.5 years ago. We don't know about the K4 HD, which would be a hybrid superhet module added to the direct sampling radio. So no idea when it'll come out and what it'll cost. But the K4 is like, as expected, 100 dB radio. It only has one receiver, but you can have two slices if you want to use Flex's term. So you could actually be listening to a D-Expedition main receiver on the D-Expedition and the sub-receiver, or the second slice on Who's Calling, and you want to find a hole there, or maybe who worked him last. If you're on the same band, then there's no issue. If you did want to listen on a different band, you can do that with the straight K4 single ADC receiver, but the LC front end would have to go broadband. In other words, the 20-meter filter would have to go away, or the 40-meter filter. The one thing that's a little odd with the K4 is the transmit low-pass filters in the circuit all the time, which is an issue if the second receiver frequency you want to monitor is like you're on 20 and you want to listen to 15 or 10, see if it's open, that's going to be an issue. There's a workaround to some extent. The K4D, of course, doesn't have that problem. It's got two receivers, two ADCs, two complete sets of bandpass filters, just like the ICOM 7610. When I got my hands on a K4 just over a year ago, and my friend N0QO, Ken, we spent weeks testing the radio. It was really early in its development of firmware. There were all sorts of bugs everywhere. And of course, we talked to Wayne about it on email, on the phone, and all that information was passed on, and a lot of them have been corrected. So it's a, as Wayne says, it's a software-defined radio, so you'd hope that most anything that's not quite right will get fixed down the road. So the challenge for the K4 is they're kind of last to the market with a direct sampling radio. The Apache 100D came out 9 years ago, including Pure Signal, which is a way to clean up the sideband so the splatter is like 20 dB less. It's amazing. The 6700, which was Flex's new architecture 7 years ago. The 7300, that kind of a, was it, I call it a game changer. It was, of course, not the top of the line radio, but the price that came out started at $1,500 within like a year, was down to $1,000. 6 years ago, the 7610, which is what I'm using in my shack here, 5 years ago. So Elecraft's just been shipping really for 15 months. The beta update that came out Monday before the Dayton Hamvention just came out on the 16th. And there were problems with it noted by Tuesday and Wednesday. So Wayne sent out an email to the Reflector on groups.io and said, we need more testers. I know they've got enough testers now, but it was interesting that one day before my presentation at Contest University, Wayne was asking to get more help in finding bugs. And then he was talking about regression testing so that when you do have a new firmware beta, that it didn't break something else. So this is, I'm glad that I don't have to write software. So the sort of history of the K4, when it shipped February of 2001, it had version 15. By the time I saw the radio, it was 17, and then some really quick updates due to two major problems, 18 and 19. I didn't get to operate the K4D until December of last year, and they were up to 26, R26, and there were a couple things that really stood out. And so they got corrected in R28, which was the EQ didn't work on transmit. The speech processor didn't work until R29, but then they pulled R29. And the DSP selectivity was improved on R29. But then R29 went away, and they're right now on R30 beta version 2. So here's what really caught me by surprise. I was in the contest, 160 meter CW in December, first weekend of December. And I was noting that if I was working a weak guy and there was a really strong guy nearby and I had this filter bandwidth set to 100 hertz, I kept hearing this guy that was like 90 hertz away. It was really affecting copies. So I switched over to my 7610 and the problem went away. Like, what's going on? So being a techie nerd, I stopped in the middle of the contest, fired up some test equipment and measured the selectivity of the K4D at 100 hertz bandwidth and then compared it to 7610. Well, if you looked at the minus 40 dB attenuation value, you can see there was a 2-to-1 difference between 100 hertz on the K4, and I see that says KD4, it should say K4D, and the 7610. So that was the problem. But no one had posted this, and I was flabbergasted. So on a Monday, I posted this information, and lo and behold, within a day, four people said they'd operated CQ Worldwide CW the weekend before, and they noticed the selectivity wasn't up to snuff, but no one had mentioned it on the air. So, of course, Wayne got down to the programming, and there's two options now, what the selectivity was before, or the sharp one that's probably similar to the 7610, but I've not seen a radio since then. I have to borrow a radio. So I did run it in contest, the 160 CW, the ARRL 10 meters. I didn't spend that much time on 160 because I quit and was up running test equipment, and so I just only worked 100 stations. 10 meters was more fun because I just decided we're not going to stop in the middle of the contest. 400 Qs, and so it worked out fine within the limitations of R26. But the selectivity wasn't adequate. The audio gain wasn't adequate. So those of all course, Elecraft has either fixed them or they're in the process. I found a mouse really helpful on the K4. The FTDX10, amazing little radio. The lap numbers are very similar to what's in the 101D or the MP. The ergonomics aren't as good because the buttons and knobs are closer together. And I have some complaints with the display, but the receiver works. I mean, there's no trouble working a CW contest. There were updates last year in April and May. There was a bug in the April. They fixed it in May. Yaesu for years has been known for terrible key clicks. No longer. Three cheers. They got this. They're doing great now. The funny thing is, of course, all the new radios have a band scope and a waterfall. And the advertisements hype the 3D waterfall. Three-dimensional waterfall. It looks like the beginning of the original Star Wars, where things are going into the distance. But the strange thing is, to me, a waterfall is history. I want to see about a minute of what's been going on for the last minute so that I can work a station if I'm doing S&P, search and pounce, that I'll just work a station. There's the next guy, go to the waterfall, tune in the signal on the waterfall. But with the original software for all three radios, the 101, D or MP, and the 10, as soon as you sent one dit or pushed the push-to-talk and said CQ, all that history went away, which was crazy. They did fix it there in April of last year for the 2D waterfall for all three rigs, but the 3D waterfall still has the same problem. So I don't see the point of it, but some people like it. Who knows? I would like to see more time for the waterfall. I think the way mine's set up, it's only got like 10 seconds. I want to see about 50 or 60. So the FTDX10 got some firmware updates in December of last year. And there was an update just last month to fix a minor bug that I didn't see. But that's what we want to see, that our companies fixing things, fixing bugs, because they're software and they can be updated. And we hope in a reasonable time frame. So the contest, I only ran the FTDX10 and basically a year and a half ago, CQ Worldwide, 160 CW. I worked a couple hundred stations. I didn't have the whole weekend to operate. I didn't operate Saturday evening or Sunday at all. But I did get to work three JAs. So if you're working JAs on 160, you're doing fine. I was on the air about 7 hours. The audio peak filter worked great. The selectivity, DSP selectivity, worked great. Ergonomics, a bit of a compromise, but I was giving a presentation to the Arizona Outlaws contest group, and a guy said, I'm ordering a second FTDX10. Do you do SO2R? I asked him about the ergonomics, and he says, I don't even touch the radio. Everything's run from my logging program, so a non-issue. The band scope's kind of jumpy. People have complained about that when the 101D first shipped. It needs averaging. A mouse is really helpful because of the soft buttons are kind of small. The TR switch, it is not solid-state switching like some rigs, so it does make noise. And the tuner is really slow and noisy, but it tunes, so in 20 seconds, the noise goes away. The 107, I don't know, 705, I mean, I don't know how many people have seen this, but, you know, it's the size of a brick. It goes 160 to 70 centimeters. Its dynamic range is about like a 7300 with IP plus off. Well, what the heck is IP plus? Well, ICOM invented the term, but that's a dither on the analog to digital conversion chip. That's a linearization process built into the chip. Now, Flex does it differently. Their chip doesn't have dither, but they do it a different way. It accomplishes the same thing. So in this little tiny radio that runs on batteries, internal or external, they don't have that feature, but it's not a real big deal. For the most part, on the lower bands at least, I've tried to hear when I turn IP plus on or off on the ICOM, and you can do it on some other rigs like the Apache, I don't notice a difference. But I'm going to guess, and this is a guess, if I'm on 10 meters at the top of the sunspot cycle, no, we're getting there, things are improving, as you heard this morning, that if we had, you know, hundreds of stations on a CW contest, it would be easiest to hear this on 10 meters, the band noise is going to be 30 dB lower. And if the linearity of the ADC chip is better with the dither on, the IP plus on, which it is, then we should hear a difference. There may be these funny little beep, beep, bleep, beep signals that don't make any sense from a CW standpoint because it's just a distortion product when signals are popping on and off the air. So that's going to be my guess that we'll hear that difference in the coming years. For HF operation, if you can run a 7300, you can run a 705. It has lots of VHF features that, of course, aren't in the 7300. The ergonomics are very good. The scope display is, it has averaging, whatever you want to do. The user interface is the same for a 7300, a 7610, a 9700, which is the VHF, UHF, or now this little 705. If you can run one and you're used to it, it's like 5 minutes to know the other one. In midsummer last year, ICOM did an update to all these radios, a great scrolling feature, which worked much better if you were doing search and pounce or just tuning to go find a signal that you can see on the scope. The waterfall would skew off at an angle. But now if you use the scroll feature, I mean, there are other ways to run the radio so that with fixed endpoints, but I don't do it that way. So the scroll feature made the radio almost as good as the TS-890S, which was the best from my standpoint, the way I run contests. And the little receiver, the DC light receiver, as a similar interface. Again, if you run a 7300, you can figure out how the 8600 receiver works. So what did I operate with the 705? I wasn't running QRP. It's 5 watts with the battery. It's 10 watts with an external supply, either a bigger battery or a 13-volt battery, 12-volt battery. So I was driving an amplifier. I ran sweepstakes. I just did the first 100 contacts just to see how it worked. It was fine. The only problem was I had to use push to talk on the hand mic, and there's no headset still available that works on Vox. So trying to work a contest with a push to talk, not my cup of tea. So I ran it in the 160 contest, almost 400 contacts. I worked a couple of JAs with this little tiny radio, 80 sections. I was on the air for more than 16 hours. 10 meter contest the next weekend. No trouble with sensitivity, weak signal reception, no problem. And then there were e-skip openings on 10 meters. And again, I missed the Vox, but hopefully somebody will come out with a Vox. Hello, Heil, bring out a Vox, a headset that works with Vox. Comments on the 7610. This currently is my reference radio. A reference radio doesn't mean it's a perfect radio, but I know what it does. It used to be my reference radio was a pure analog ICOM 781. So currently, if I'm evaluating radios, you can't do it to memory. And if something seems funny, like in the case of the K4 selectivity, you switch over to the other radio and tune in the same signal and see what's happening. So the 7610, it's easy to adjust the default bandwidths. The audio peak filter works great, etc. Silent switching, so there's no relays clicking away, so I like that. It does have a drive adjustment, which adjusts the AGC, the ALC. The drive adjustment affects the ALC, and that's kind of flaky. So I recommend, since there's no scale on the 7610, that you just set it for a reading on the S meter scale of 5. And you really use the second receiver in the 7610, you need that $300 separate tuning knob. But then Flex has a tuning knob, and Elecraft has a tuning knob, and they all cost about $300. So that's just the way it is. I bought mine used for $200. So the contest that I run with the 7610, well, I was evaluating the K4D, so I had to have my reference radio so I could go back and forth. Worked the December 160 contest, the 10-meter contest. You can't evaluate a radio by memory. And so you really need to be able to do real time if something doesn't seem right. For instance, way back when the ICOM 7800 shipped and was tested in QST, the lab guy, which was probably Bob, but the someone who actually wrote the hands-on review, he disconnected his radio, and I think it may have been a TS-930, but I'm not sure. And he hooked up the new ICOM. And in the review, it said, I'm hearing signals on the ICOM that I wouldn't have heard on the other radio, but I didn't listen to the other radio. So that was a stupid comment. So you can't do an A-B comparison if you only got A. So if you buy a new radio, I'm suggesting if financially if it's acceptable, don't get rid of your previous radio when you buy a new one, at least for a while, because you can't compare them to buy memory. So that's it. I'll quit screen sharing here. So again, rob@nc0b.com. My website with all those 150 radios is nc0b.com. And there we are, finished up. Ball's in your court.
Well, thank you very much there, Rob. Does anybody in the room have any last-minute questions that they thought of for him before we let him go here?
Great presentation.
That was a fantastic presentation. Lots of great information there, Rob. Thank you very much. Enjoyed having you here. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, you're welcome. And, you know, it's almost like drinking out of a fire hose. A lot of information there if you take. So enjoy the rest of your ham fest, and thanks for coming today.
Hey, thank you very much.
73.